This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamir.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, wondering how our new Democratic president might change things for Alaska.
One of the things to keep in mind, the president is just the president.
Don Young sets us straight. Alaska's post-election political scene and some other new stuff. New restaurant in Juneau, a PR campaign to rename fish something more cuddly, and a new career at home. All that and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Tuesday evening, Alaskans heard the acceptance speech of the new U.S. president just as the state polls were shutting down.
Black, white, Hispanic, Asian, Native American, gay, straight, disabled, and not disabled, Americans who sent a message to the world that we have never been just a collection of individuals or a collection of red states and blue states. We are and always will be the United States of America.
Barack Obama will be the 44th president of the United States when he's sworn in January. But how does that and our own state election results change things for Alaska?
One of the things to keep in mind, the president is just the president, that they didn't gain the House seats they thought they were going to gain. They didn't gain the Senate seats. So
that's irascible Congressman Don Young on election night. Young has apparently defied predictions and trounced Democratic challenger Ethan Berkowitz in the race for Alaska's lone U.S. House seat. Young says the election won't make much difference in the makeup of Congress, but one Alaska race is bound to make a lot of difference to that august body and to Alaskans back home. With no official final count yet, Senator Ted Stevens and Anchorage's Mark Begich are far from the end of their battle.
No, I don't have any comments yet.
Senator Stevens partied on election night with well-wishers but refused to talk to the press. He finally went home and got some rest in the wee hours as opponent Begich and his entourage paraded through the cold streets of Anchorage from their election eve party down to Election Central at the city's Egan Center.
It's, as I've always said, it's going to be a tight race. That's what we're experiencing right now. And we'll wait till all those votes come in and there's over 50,000 more votes still to come. You know, obviously the absentees that haven't been counted. I mean, my vote hasn't even been counted.
So far, there's less than 2 percentage points separating them, with Stevens on the high end. Unlike silent Uncle Ted, Mayor Mark called a press conference on the day after the election to make sure everyone knew he was keeping an eye on the vote count.
We have a few lawyers and also people around the region districts, but the first is just to make sure we understand the process of how they're going to verify what our ballots are going to count. The next thing, obviously, is to observe the counting. And so we just want to make sure that the process is adhered to.
The Division of Elections promises to have all the votes tallied by November 21st to see who's heading to Washington. It may take a bit longer to know the future of another famous Alaskan. Sarah Palin came home to Wasilla on Election Day long enough to cast her vote, then flew back to Arizona to be with John McCain on Election Eve. She returned to Alaska Wednesday night, her last trip on the McCain-Palin campaign jet. She says she'll knuckle right down in Juneau, but there's plenty of speculation about her future. Some wonder if she will be taking a leading role in the National Republican Party.
Forever, I'm going to be Sarah from Alaska.
Palin is under scrutiny for her pre-election spending spree at some of New York's tonier fashion houses. According to press reports, Palin and her family spent upwards of $150,000 on clothes for the campaign trail. The party says the clothes will be donated to charity, but perhaps they'll let her hang on to some sensible shoes and a good raincoat for Juneau's blustery weather.
Her face is a map of the world, is a map of the world.
political pundits predicted that this year's state general election would deliver the roundhouse punch necessary to knock the Republican Party to the mat. But that didn't really pan out. So far, six races are still to be decided. It's those absentee and early ballots that are holding up the decision for now. So we asked UAF journalism professor Charles Fedullo to share his views on what's likely to be in store for the next legislature. I asked him if the predicted Democratic sweep even happened.
Clearly, it did not. When you look at the federal races, the congressional seats that were up, Mark Begich and Ted Stevens is still very close, although leaning Stevens, and I would be surprised to see that race change. I would be even more surprised to see the Ethan Berkowitz-Don Young race change. The one area where the Democrats were successful looks like is Senate seat E in Fairbanks, moving back to the state legislature, where Joe Pascvan, a Democrat running for an open seat, defeated Republican Cynthia Henry. I think it's a sign that as much as the country went blue, certainly Alaska showed its colors as being a Republican state.
So let's take a look at some of the state district races. Can you pinpoint which are the most compelling regarding the balance of power in Juneau?
Well, I think you look at the South Anchorage races. Let's start in the Senate. And I had already mentioned the big race in the state Senate was for Senate District E, and that was the race between Joe Pascvan and Cynthia Henry. Why was that a big race? Well, both Republicans and Democrats in state had targeted that as the seat that was imperative towards what was going to happen with the Alaska State Senate. The Alaska State Senate, with that seat, is now a coalition. There's 10 Democrats there and 10 Republicans, and they announced leaderships today. And it's a bipartisan leading group with 10 Democrats and 3 Republicans. So the Senate will be predominantly run by Democrats, but with 3 Republicans in the majority, and that's significant. The Democrats will have control of what happens in the Senate. When it comes to the House, it is a completely different ball of wax. Republicans maintain a certain amount of control there, a strong amount of control in the Alaska House.
Is there new blood in the House that may put up more of a resistance against Republican policies?
I think incumbents did fairly well across the board and fairly well in the House. If you look at races that were expected to be close, where incumbents existed, they, for the most part, did not materialize. If you look at the House, while there may be some exceptions, incumbents did well.
I understand there's still maybe 6 state races that are undecided, not counting Stevens Begich. Are any of those pivotal?
I think every race is pivotal. I think every district believes that their lawmaker is going to take care of them. So in those regards, are they pivotal? Absolutely. In the regards to control in the House, no, they are not pivotal.
Okay, last question and the $64,000 question. The wild card, Governor Sarah Palin. You have just told me that the Democrats will hold sway in the Senate. Would this be the mirror image of the Tony Knowles and the Republican-controlled Senate situation, which didn't get anyone anywhere as far as I could see?
It's going to be an interesting position. Sarah Palin comes home after having been an attack dog in a presidential race. Sarah Palin's view is that was her job. That was what she was supposed to do, be John McCain's attack dogs. Only time is going to tell if the Democrats will feel resentment towards Governor Palin for what she said on the campaign trail. I think early on, when we start looking at the budget and we start looking at how the relationships between the House and Senate and the governor are going, you'll have a better idea. It will come in the Senate. And I think that a key relationship to watch will be the relationship between Lyman Hoffman, who is going to be a co-chair of finance in the Senate, and the governor. Rural Alaska has been critical of the governor for not paying more attention to their issues and not hearing their concerns. And Lyman Hoffman, being a Democrat from the bush, how he responds to Sarah Palin could hold some sway in what the relationship looks like. I think that it will be a struggle. people underestimate Sarah Palin. So while I think there could be some problems with the relationship, I think she has shown herself to be an effective politician who knows how to mend bridges and work with people.
Okay, and speaking of Sarah, the speculation is rife that if Ted Stevens wins his race, and if he has to resign, and if a special election is called, Sarah could be running against Mark Begich? Would that blow your mind or what?
Well, I think when you look at how things shake out, it seems logical, doesn't it? You would have, if Ted Stevens were to resign, who is the most high-profile and likely successful Republican to replace Ted Stevens in a special election? I think Sarah Palin has to come to that top of that list.
University of Alaska Fairbanks journalism professor Charles Fadulo. On the streets of Juneau, a day after the election, voters were focused on Alaska's statewide races. Scott Burton talked to several of them, and for the most part, people seemed a bit confused.
I was very confused on Alaska's choice for our Congress people, and I was hoping to get some new blood in both seats, and that didn't happen, and I think that's a real shame, but that's what it is.
Well, I feel that it's good that Congressman Young's going to stay in his seat. I don't feel that a convicted felon should be able to run for anything.
It was rather disappointing that Ted Stevens and Don Young held in, but take what we can get.
The one surprising thing that I found is that Alaskans still voted for Ted Stevens.
Alaska is still a really young state, and maybe we'll grow up one of these days.
But despite Alaska's strong vote for John McCain, these voters were pleased, some elated, with their new president.
Obama always makes me cry whenever he starts talking. I don't know why, and a lot of my friends feel the same way. We just tear up, and I saw a lot of people in the crowds in Chicago having the same reaction, and I'm excited to move out of Alaska and go down south and see what's happening with him as president.
Well, I was just really happy that Obama won, you know, and I think he's going to probably do us a good job.
I feel disenfranchised sometimes, and he has made me and my friends feel like we will have a voice, and things like I'll be able to get health care, these things. I don't know if it's really true, but I think that's what it is.
We're going to be hurting. Our economy is going to be hurting for at least 3 years. There is no quick and easy answer. I'll be very disappointed if he goes for a quick and easy answer. He needs to do long-term fixing. There's no fast fix. There isn't. There can't be. If we get a fast fix, we're screwing something else up.
Are you hopeful?
Very.
More stories of hope and new beginnings after the break. Welcome back to AK. We'll move on from elections in just a minute, I promise. But before we do, we'll take one last look. APRN's coverage team included a newcomer this year. She's not new to elections, just to American ones. Sheena Mackay is a veteran of the BBC in Britain.
When I first revealed to family and friends earlier this year that we were coming to live in Alaska for 4 years, the first question they usually asked was, "Is that America or Canada?" What a difference 68 days makes. Now they ask me if I've been to Wasilla, whether there's a Neiman Marcus in Anchorage. Conversations and emails are peppered with references to Sarah. Just Sarah, that is. Because as a result of Sarah Palin's global fame, she's now part of that elite celebrity group of women like Madonna, Diana, Oprah, who are instantly recognised by their first name only. Certainly they were disappointed when they realised that the Anchorage elections results event at the Egan Centre wasn't attended by Sarah. For most of the night, even the people who make the local elections so interesting were missing. Obama supporters were reduced to having their photos taken with a life-sized cardboard cutout of the president-elect, or next to a young man who looked remarkably like Obama. I recommend he contact Joe the plumber's agent. A whole new career possibly awaits. As a reporter, it was strange to wait for election results in a room full of people I didn't know. Usually, I'd be on first-name terms with the candidates, their campaign teams, their supporters. How was I to know that the gentleman I hustled from one side of the room to the other would turn out to be Hollis French, mentioned by some as the next possible Alaska Senate leader? All I knew was I'd been asked to prevent him being waylaid by the TV stations, and I took my job seriously. No one was getting near my man until my mission was complete. We British love our pomp and ceremony, and election result nights are no exception. Every district has a returning officer, the person in charge of the local election, and they get their brief moment in the spotlight when they declare the results, usually in a ponderous fashion, to eke out the suspense. It's only then that supporters of the candidates hear the numbers and the winner is confirmed. I miss that moment at the Anchorage event, that frisson of excitement going through the room, the cheers for the winner, the victory speeches. Somehow, rolling computer screens just didn't generate much of an atmosphere. Only when Ethan Berkowitz and Don Young entered the room did the crowd become electrified. Suddenly it was like the standoff at the OK Corral, rival groups of supporters trying to outdo each other, shouting their candidate's name. "Ethan, Don Young, Ethan, Don Young," they cried. In Britain, campaigns are far shorter. The last general election was called a month ahead of time. Any group with 10 supporters can put forward a candidate, so it's much easier for a variety of voices to be heard. Each constituency elects a Member of Parliament, and the leader of that party with the majority of MPs becomes Prime Minister. It's simple. None of this complicated electoral college stuff. Then there's the money. Strictly limited amounts can be spent. There's no TV advertising, let alone spending millions to commandeer the networks. The British system has its advantages, at least in my view, but it is missing something right now, the political magic of a Barack Obama. We could use a party leader who can inspire young voters, who can engage ethnic minorities, whose candidacy can go a long way to eradicating voter apathy. It was a great privilege to share with the American people their moment of defining history. I'll never forget where I was when the networks declared Barack Obama the first African-American president-elect.
The reflections of Sheena Mackay after election night.
I know we can make it. I know darn well we can work it out. Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Why can't we? Yes, we can.
New beginnings often start with remaking the old, as our next story proves. A downtown Juneau landmark has avoided demolition, at least for now. The owners of Merchants Wharf wanted to close down the 69-year-old sprawling emporium at the end of this year, but with the prospect of new owners and plans for a restaurant, the old building has a new beginning. Weld Royal has the story.
What went up during the Great Depression as a utilitarian structure has grown into a ramshackle mall along a prominent stretch of downtown Juneau's waterfront. Merchants Wharf was designed to house seaplanes but evolved into a miniature of Seattle's Pike Place Market with restaurants, antique sellers, and a tanning parlor. Some fervent locals see the slate-blue two-story wooden building as a living testament to Juneau's colorful waterfront past. Daniel Glidman wants it demolished.
The building as an entity in its own is a money-losing proposition. The building is old. It was never really built for the long haul. And you can just equate it to taking care of a very old 500-foot-long wooden ship.
Glidman has managed Merchants Wharf for the past 22 years. He says the property without the building is valuable and would make a good spot for a cruise ship dock or a new structure resistant to Southeast's wood-destroying weather. The 95,000-square-foot building is for sale with an asking price around $6 million.
the building requires so much annual maintenance that it eats up every penny of its annual rent income. And cost of fuel has all but broken the back of the property in itself.
When Glidman first took the job, the building was practically vacant except for junk stored in it. Now, even with summer tourists long gone, it's a busy place with signs of its past everywhere. On its inside walls are black and white photos of Shel Simmons and other aviation pioneers who once used the building. Locals come to the wharf for a haircut overlooking Gastineau Channel or to meet for a drink at the hangar, a restaurant and bar. Robert Sanford is a partner in Tailwind Inc., the hangar's owner. He sits at a cocktail table near the bar and says he and his two partners decided to take a stake in Merchants Wharf because they own two restaurants in the building, are planning a third, and it seemed like a risk not to buy into it.
As it stands right now, it's in our best interest as owners of the hangar to keep the building going for as long as we can. Until it decides it's not going to stand anymore, I guess.
He says they're still working out ownership details and hope to complete a deal by year's end. A few months later, they plan to open a new restaurant called Flight Deck at the building's south end. Mike Windred is joining the Tailwind Partners as a backer of the restaurant. He gushes with plans. A seafood bar will seat 100 and fill a niche in Juneau's culinary scene.
We've got some pretty good ideas, you know, putting some money down and getting not only ourselves with our experience, but also some other people involved in it that can help us make the vision happen. We've got some local engineers and architects hired.
Windred sounds almost irrationally exuberant about his plans to spend despite grim economic headlines. Nationally, credit is so tight, thousands of small businesses are cutting costs or even closing. And the restaurant industry is notoriously difficult. But Windred shrugs it off. He looks like a 30-something, but is actually closing in on 50 and retired 2 years ago after 25 years in Alaska tourism.
I don't want to say midlife crisis or anything like that, but certainly 25 years, you know, it was time for a change for me.
Windred says he also needed a place to put his retirement nest egg. He and his partners checked out other seafood bars in Redondo Beach, California, and Portland, Oregon, to figure out what would work for Juneau. He says they're pushing to open the restaurant in April and at first operate it seasonally. Not everyone is excited about its plans. For the last 4 years, Colette Costa has run a popular diner in the section of the wharf that will soon be Flight Deck. Costa wonders if three restaurants in one building owned by the same organization will limit Juneau's dining picks. Her place was known for its white trash, Eggs Benedict, and other unique specialties, and its eclectic patrons. She says they packed the place after she announced plans to close.
I feel like it's just kind of hitting its stride right now, too. Because I finally understand how to run it. What's my signature dish? Anything that doesn't kill you.
BLT. BLT with a fried egg on it. That's mine.
For now, Costa has no intention of opening elsewhere, but her story and her specialties will be among those contributing to the wharf's colorful past. In Juneau, I'm Welsh Royal.
Now it's time for AK's weekly trip around the state. This week, we visit Chignik Lagoon in the Aleutians and Deering, south of Kotzebue.
I am Vivian Brandl, and I live in Chignik Lagoon, and I work for Chignik Lagoon Native Corporation as the secretary. We're just on the beginning of the Aleutian Islands, and Kodiak or King Salmon are our closest hubs. Yeah, our population in Chignik Lagoon is approximately 65. Chignik Lagoon is based between Chignik Lake and Chignik Bay, and we have this beautiful lagoon here. You leave your door and you go out on your boat, and it's right there. You don't have to run very far to fish at the lagoon. Chignik means big wind, and we do get a lot of wind sometimes, especially in the fall and during the equinox. And then during the winter, it can blow 4 or 5 days northwest. And when they named Chignik, they named it right. One of the challenges with the fisheries is we only have one buyer here, Trident Seafoods, and it seems to me like they kind of rule with the prices that they give. Last summer, we had one other buyer come in, International Seafoods from Kodiak. They sent a tender over, and they paid a little bit better price, but still the prices were below Kodiak. You know, the fish were here last summer, but the prices were suppressed. Mm-hmm.
My name is Ruth Ann Barr. I live in Deering, Alaska. I'm the IT tech / maintenance for Manila Health Center here in Deering. We are on the south of the Kotzebue Sound, just like 65 miles across the sound from Kotzebue. Approximately right now, we have about 130 to 135 residents. We are very big on subsistence. We have caribou, moose. We fish, we get seals, we've on occasion gotten beluga whales, and we get bird eggs, we do everything, you know, the berries, the whole works. I think our biggest challenges right now is the high, you know, cost of the heating fuel, and we have hardly any employment opportunities in the village. With SEER, people are not very interested in because we don't offer, you know, health insurance and stuff like that. Due to that, a lot of people have left in the last few years. There's a lot of history here. It goes back like 1,500 years. So we're trying to, you know, rebuild our community back up. We're doing road improvements and we're water and sewer improvements. So hopefully, you know, with the alternative energy, we should have wind generators up here soon. So with all this new stuff coming in, we hope this will encourage people to stay instead of leave.
We heard from Vivian Brandl in Chignik Lagoon and Ruth Ann Barr in Deering. Several weeks ago, we heard the story of Huna, a southeast village almost entirely destroyed by a fire in 1944. Those memories are still vivid for the residents that lived through it. But after the fire, it was a time to pull together, to learn from the tragedy, and to move forward into a new era. Last summer, Ann Kaiser sat down with Huna residents who still remember just how quickly their lives changed.
When we came back to look where our house was at, all our beds were all burned and out of shape. And my husband's guns, his rifles, were all apart. They're all burned. They look just like medals. So it hurts. And my husband said, we'll make it.
The Coast Guard came in and they fed the people. And then it was very good, you know, kids, we went down, you know, a little bite to eat. They were really good to us. It was Storrs, was the name of the Coast Guard boat.
A lot of people moved to Juneau to find jobs, and some moved to the excursion to put up food because the company let them stay in the cannery houses down over there.
Before we were a state or anything, my uncle, Harry Douglas, had kind of a inside track with the governor of Alaska at that time, you know, which was appointed by the federal government.
So Harry went to Juneau to see the governor. And in 1 week, everything was arranged.
It didn't take long for the government, the army, to move in these army huts. They set up the army huts on the school ground and on the along the road by the Presbyterian Church.
So the news came that in a few months we'll have a barge here for a new home.
The houses were headed for the South Pacific, for Guam, by the military, and Governor Gruening got them diverted to Huna, the 80, what they called war housing. And they were built without any insulation because they didn't need insulation in Guam. So that was the one bad thing. And people, the houses weren't very warm for the first few years until the people got them insulated.
Things were hard. There was no job. People got by very poorly. And during that time, my husband said, we're going to have to do something. And he said, I know what to do. And I said, what are you going to do? He said, it will inspire them to forget our problem of the loss we have. It's a big loss. Somebody has to stir up and find a way back. And all the elderly men that were in the AMB band, they practiced band just to cheer up, and they got to enjoy themselves. They looked forward to each gathering every weekend.
We got better roads, came in, and the city was incorporated. And we did get attention from the federal government, who came in and helped with funding for, you know, not only the housing, but water and sewer was put in. We didn't have running water before Winona burned. We didn't have sewage, and we didn't have electricity. So these all came after the fire when they rebuilt Una.
People really worked hard. And for some people, it was a downfall. It was hard to get back. They got their homes. Then they got the city office going. They started all new things. Harold Douglas became the mayor. They elected city council. The fishing season was changing. All kinds of things happened.
The time it took to rebuild Huna was marked with glimpses of hope as the government poured financial aid into the village. But even with the new city government, the modern conveniences, and all the other changes that came along, there was still one vital component missing: a better educational system. That situation didn't improve until after statehood, when the government agreed to build a high school there. Some folks wonder if it ever would have happened had it not been for the fire. In some ways, the fire shaped Huna into a village no one ever expected. Coming up after the break, finding a new perspective on potato chips.
You still like the crunch, you still like the salt, but knowing that you can have it at any time makes it powerless over you.
That's just ahead. You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Ellen Lockyer, and this week we're talking about new beginnings. Some people may think they can get a new beginning by changing the way they look, losing weight, or getting a new hairdo, but Wise at Every Size is a program that encourages healthy living and helps people learn to appreciate the bodies they already have. It is not a weight loss program. As AK's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock learns, women who have gone through the program in Sitka have found that it gives them a whole new outlook.
When you're born, most babies are born as intuitive eaters. They eat when they're hungry and they stop when they're full.
Health educator Marcy Getz is talking about one aspect of the Wise at Every Size program. The 10-week class encourages women to think about food and their bodies in a whole new way. Or, depending on how you look at it, in a very old, intuitive way.
Dieting puts your body in a state of starvation. It feels like it's starving, and it does everything it can to ward that off. And that used to be a real mechanism to help us when we were hunters and gatherers. It might not be so helpful today, but we still have it. So the reality is that it's not just one reason why someone isn't successful dieting, and I think that there's still that myth around that it's just about willpower.
On a recent Saturday, a group of women who had already completed the Wise at Every Size program got together for an alumni class. Because so much of what they discuss in the class deals with food and relationships, they started off by thinking of themselves as a specific food.
My name is Sharon, and I associate with being a salmonberry because I feel like I'm very sweet, and or I can be very sweet, and I can be tart also, and it's just one of my favorite berries because growing up with my grandmother, we always went out and picked salmon berries together.
My name's Anne, and I think I'm an apple because
I'm kind of shaped like an apple, and people tell me that I'm sweet, but really I can be kind of tart when I feel like I want to be. So I'm going to say I'm an apple.
I should have started. That was mine.
Other foods in the group were mixed nuts, avocados, and different brands of potatoes. When the laughter about how long you should cook yourself died down, the conversation turned to stereotypes and how prevalent they are in our society.
And it also makes me more aware of the number of people that look at me and say, well, she's fat, so she's obviously, you know, has some emotional problem in her life. Otherwise, she would have taken better care of herself. That's a stereotype that is really hard to break through, but being aware of it is the first step in breaking through it.
You know, I've been a pretty average weight or slender most of my life, you know, but I've still gotten caught up in, you know, trying to lose a few pounds. And I think the hunger scale was really a good thing for me to think about because I eat sometimes for emotional reasons, or, you know, I find myself being stressed out and reach for that chocolate, you know, to make myself feel better, that kind of thing.
It was an interesting class to be able to take because it was able to see other people in the same boat I was. We're all different sizes, but we're all dealing with the old D-I-E-T word. And diet. Life is life, isn't it?
For that reason, many of the women referenced the Diet Survivor's Handbook, which defines one of the concepts taught in the class, intuitive eating, being free to eat what you're hungry for when you're hungry.
And so when we can get beyond the I have to diet phase and think about I can eat as healthy, you know, as anybody of any size, and concentrate on the health rather than the weight, then we give ourselves permission to have the cheesecake for dessert if we want it. But we don't feel like we're deprived if we don't. It's a liberating thing.
And there are things that people can do to help change how they relate to food. Maybelle Filler says it was the realization that there is no such thing as good and bad foods. Food is just food. She says the exercise that stuck with her was to buy the one food that she had always seen as forbidden and make sure there was a lot of it around. So Maybelle filled her freezer with Häagen-Dazs butter pecan ice cream and told her family not to touch it. It was her homework.
But it was more than that. The process is that you had to turn off the TV, the radio, and really concentrate on what you were eating, called mindful eating. And when I did that, I found that I really... it wasn't that it was a different sort of ice cream. It was always the same ice cream, but the taste was different. Like, it wasn't as sweet as I remember or as creamy as I remember. And it was still good. Häagen-Dazs is still good ice cream. And it was like I wasn't eating as much.
Wellene Woodson says she put bags of potato chips all over her house.
What you're doing is you're going to take the value that you've placed on that bag of potato chips away. So, because you're not going to deprive yourself any more of it. You still like the crunch, you still like the salt. But knowing that you can have it at any time makes it powerless over you.
The Wise at Every Size class also helps women focus on things like joyful movement and having a good self-image, regardless of their size. Marcy Getz says if women feel like they're giving up before they go through the Wise at Every Size program, afterwards they find that they've actually done the opposite. Just ask Wellene Woodson.
I felt like I was being let free. Welcome back to the world that should always be out there for everybody.
Getz says it's hard for women to accept that they may always be the size they are right now. But it's important to realize that you can be fit, you can lower your cholesterol and your blood sugar levels, and actually have a healthy life, whatever your weight is. And she says this way of thinking can truly be a new beginning. For AK, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
When Clint Farr and Denise Koch had their first baby, Clint was the breadwinner for a year and a half. His daughter, Carmen, stayed home with mom. But eventually, money got tight, and Denise went back to work. Now the two have a new baby, Sienna, and this time Clint wants to try something new.
This time around, I'd like to stay home. Some of the rationale is selfish. I think I'd be good at it. I want to prove it. I'm also, frankly, anxious to try a different career. Ultimately, it comes down to avoiding regret on my deathbed. As I lie there, gasping, well, I think, you know, I wish I spent more time at work and less time with my children. I don't think so. Here's a rare chance to anticipate and avoid a regret. So Denise and I are exploring me staying home.
Would I support you? Yes.
Yes. Would that support be financial?
Emotional? Spiritual? all three?
I needed to talk to a stay-at-home dad. Fortunately, my neighbor, Pat Minnick, is one.
The thing about going over to Pat's house is that he's my neighbor. Yeah. Has been for years. 3 children. Now getting on up in age. The oldest is approaching 8. The youngest approaching 5. Hi.
Pat used to work for a social services agency as a care provider. Now he's something different.
Really what I'm known as is Toby's dad or Molly's dad or Elias's dad. That's pretty much my job description title.
When they first became parents, Pat and his wife Kim Champney both worked part-time, sharing responsibility for the kids and juggling work hours.
And then after our third one, it just got to be too much shuffling, and we were both working part-time, and neither of us could really move forward in our jobs.
Pat was burned out at work, and Kim could move forward, but only if she worked full-time.
Neither of us were doing anything particularly well. We weren't all that great in our jobs. We weren't all that great with being parents, even though our kids were with us, one of us, all the time. We were kind of running around a lot. We kind of felt like single parents. We didn't see each other that much.
Just seemed to make sense.
Of course, losing one income has serious financial implications. Denise is supportive, but worried.
I do have some nervousness, and I know it's not fair because you did it for a year. Just that, oh, wow, now I'm totally financially responsible for the family for a little bit of this while, and it's not challenging from a gender role perspective. It's just more of, wow, anytime I've worked, we've always both been working, so I haven't felt the full gravity of kind of the family finances kind of on my shoulders.
But being the working mom doesn't just mean more responsibility. It means not being the parent most able to handle the kids. Kim's mom recognized that during a visit.
And the kids were misbehaving or something, and I was just not dealing with it well. And my mom said something to me like, you were like your dad used to be. I'm not around them, and I didn't know, like, I had lost my ability to parent them. And my mom said something like, you're like the working dad who doesn't know what they're supposed to be doing with their kids. Thanks, Mom. Very much. But I was feeling that way. I was just like, where's Pat? He didn't know how to deal with this.
Dads at home face their challenges, too. Doug Standerwick says spending all his time with a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old isn't always fun.
But that's also one of the biggest gratifications as well.
Doug worked for the state before he was hired at home.
You're on call 24/7, yeah, basically. And it's not realistic that your spouse comes home from the job that she was at for 10 hours and you want to go play a softball game or, you know, go out fishing or whatever and leave your spouse who just got off work to deal with the 2 kids. So mm-hmm. That just isn't a realistic thing. And that is something to get accustomed to, the idea.
And right now, doing stuff like fishing while mom is at work is a challenge too.
Have you been able to take advantage of your stay-at-home daddydom to do a little bit of that with your kids? Or is that just a myth or a dream?
Kind of a dream at this point, but I see it happening here pretty soon because Grace turns 5 in January. Aaron just turned 3 in the end of October. So, you know, probably next spring, I'm thinking that they'll both be old enough to behave somewhat in a boat situation,
right,
and listen to what I tell them to do. And
right,
you don't have to be holding on to them constantly and that sort of thing.
Okay, so fishing is out for a while. I'm okay with that. I can say one thing. There was a common trait of these stay-at-home daddies. No regrets. No regrets. That being my goal here, I thought I'd pass the stay-at-home daddy idea by the person whose opinion means the most to me. What's your name, sweetheart?
Carmen.
Carmen. And how old are you?
2.5.
Carmen, what if I didn't go to work? What if I stayed at home with you and Sienna during the day? If Daddy stayed at home, would you like that? Yes, please. Now, you know that means you wouldn't be going to daycare. Would you rather go to daycare or would you rather Daddy stay home?
I'd rather go to daycare.
She wants to go to daycare? For AK and Juno, I'm Clint Farr.
Most candidates have reached the end of their campaign season, but PETA is just getting started. At the beginning of October, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals launched a new campaign, Save the Sea Kittens. They no longer consider tuna the chicken of the sea, but rather the cat. KUCB's Ann Hillman has more.
PETA says that fish, because they tend to be scaly, slimy, and look a little odd, have some deadly image problems.
More fish are killed for food each year than all other animals combined, but they don't get the sympathy of animals like dogs and cats. So we thought that since there is so much in a name, that a name change might be the best thing for the creatures of the sea.
PETA campaign coordinator Ashley Byrne says they've rebranded fish as sea kittens because fish and kittens have many things in common.
Studies have shown that sea kittens are intelligent and that they communicate with one another through a range of low-frequency sounds, that they recognize each other and they gather information by eavesdropping, and also that they enjoy companionship and they develop relationships with one another and even show affection.
The campaign is aimed at children and their parents, and Byrne says it's well-received. The Save the Sea Kittens website gives people a chance to read sea kitten bedtime stories and design their own sea kitten friends. Byrne says it reminds parents to set an example of compassion for their children.
Most parents would never dream of spending a family weekend torturing kittens, but hooking a fish through the mouth and dragging him through the water is really the same as hooking a cat through the mouth and dragging him behind your car.
But many people in the fishing town of Onalaska think equating fish and kittens doesn't make sense.
No, I don't feel that they have fur, and they're not very cuddly.
I feel that it's pretty silly and dumb and unintelligent. I don't understand how it makes sense.
Doesn't that sound a bit perverted? You know, that's like going to a brothel. We got sea kittens for sale.
Mary Powers, who works on fishing boats collecting data on the catches, says she thinks the campaign is misguided.
In some countries, kittens are a good food group, and I think fish is a good food group. But as far as, it seems like it's discouraging Americans to buy our product, which I think is, unpatriotic.
But PETA's Byrne says even if people lose jobs in the fishing industry through the success of the campaign, they can work in more sea kitten-friendly environments.
If jobs are lost in the fishing industry or other, industries that are, involve meat, more jobs will be created making vegetarian foods.
Despite the opportunities the rebranding might provide, National Marine Fisheries Service Area Manager Brian Dixon says they'll continue with business as usual.
Well, it may raise some money for PETA, but I don't think it'll change the way that we manage the fisheries.
Or change the way he'll plan his meals.
I think I may eat some sea kittens tonight.
For AK, I'm Ann Hillman in Onalaska.
And that's AK for this week. We had help from Sheena Mackay in Anchorage, Weld Royal and Clint Farr in Juneau, Ann Kaiser in Hoonah, and Ann Hillman in Onalaska. Our theme music is by Bumua. Our 300 Villages theme is by Tranquilla. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org, and check out the text rundown on the archives page. While you're there, check out past shows, sign up for our podcast, or send us an email to let us know how we're doing. We're at ak aprn.org. AK's Scott Burton reported from Juneau and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock from Sitka. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. Our senior producer is Jessica Cochran. Our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Join us again next week when we get thrifty.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.